it actually, it turns out a year ago it would have been kind of a bad thing to mention what the cover story of Time is likely to be on Friday, because somebody from Newsweek really might be in the audience, and this could be a bad thing. We really don't like them to know what we're doing, and it's especially bad because the deputy managing editor of Time is sitting in the audience. So I could be in big trouble right now. But fortunately, we're now on a different publication schedule from Newsweek, so there's no way they can scoop us with this story. We didn't even mention what it was about. It doesn't matter, does it?
It doesn't matter.
So unless
can you come back up there?
No. unless the president were to commute the sentence of a big public figure. Right. No. The truth is that you never know until the very last minute. If some extremely major news event happens, all plans go out the window, and we start fresh. Which is why you should all read Time. Today, what we're going to be talking about is an issue that has grown in importance and the public consciousness, probably not enough in the public consciousness, which is why we're up here, but it's something that has increasingly worried scientists and people who care about issues that face the country and the world that have implications for science and also that have a scientific component to them, which turns out to be many, many issues that affect us. And the concern is that it was once the case, or at least so we believe, we're going to actually hear some history from one of our panelists, but when I believe it was Harry Truman who appointed the very first presidential science advisor, and the idea was that this advisor would give the president impartial advice about science and about science policy, and that decisions about science, back then we were talking a lot about nuclear weapons and nuclear power and what to do about those, that those decisions should be made on a rational basis based on the facts, on what the science actually said. And that ideal seems to have eroded significantly, especially in the past few years, to the point where, it started back at least in the 1980s and probably before, where naturally a president or a Congress has to take politics into account when making decisions, but at least the hope is that these decisions should be based on sound science and then whatever other political considerations are involved. And there's a fear that increasingly these decisions are made and justified not on the basis that no matter what the science says, here is what we're doing and here's why we're doing it, but that the science itself is being distorted, you know, in the way it's presented to the public. Distorted either by preventing scientists from speaking what they believe to be the scientific truth, that is, scientists employed by the government, or forcing them to alter what they say or what they publish, or people in press offices spinning science in such a way that it appears to be saying something it's not, or by selectively using bits and pieces. I mean, the one thing about scientific truth is that while in many cases we don't know the ultimate answer to some particular question, we at least owe it to ourselves to look at the evidence fairly and to look at all sides of the issues fairly. And the example I often use is with global warming. When I wrote my first cover story for Time about global warming in 1987, I did what journalists traditionally do. I presented the case for global warming and then the scientific uncertainties, which were then quite significant. It was not clear that this was going to happen. There was no evidence that it was yet happening, and there were reasons to believe maybe it wouldn't happen and that the predictions might not be right. And over the years, as we've done additional stories, the scientific evidence has changed, and so the way we present this issue has changed. So what was a pretty much an open scientific question in 1987 is a much, much stronger, we're much more certain of what's going on. And so we've changed the way we present things. But that's not always the case when the government has a particular political angle. And there are probably other examples that I'm not even mentioning, but I'm counting on my panelists. And that is why, at this point, I will shut up and introduce them. On my far right is Peter Glick. And I'm reading from this not because I don't know who these people are, I assure you, but I just don't want to get anything wrong. Co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland, California, an internationally recognized water expert, and that much I definitely knew, and won the MacArthur Fellowship, which in 2003, MacArthur winners do not like to call it the Genius Award, but journalists love to call it that. So he's the winner of the Genius Award. In the middle, wait a minute, let me turn to my alphabetical listing here. Dorothy Shore Zinberg, lecturer in public policy at Harvard and a founding member and faculty associate of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Kennedy School of Government. And on my right, Lawrence Krauss, professor of physics and astronomy at Case Western Reserve University, author of several popular books about science. He should be on that list.
Yeah, okay.
So it's me, Brian Green, and Krauss. But he's somebody who can write about these complex topics in a way that all of you can understand and can be entertained by. And he's also gone outside, one step outside his role as a scientist to be a popularizer of science, and then another step outside that role to be, I guess, an evangelist for the idea that scientific truth is important, not just among scientists and among journalists, but everywhere in our society, and that scientific truth is in danger from some of these forces I talked about. So I'm going to ask each of these distinguished speakers to talk a little bit about their own particular expertise and their view of this situation and how we got here. And I'm going to ask Professor Zinberg to go first because she's going to, as I understand it, give us a little bit of history.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I don't know how many of you were here yesterday, and I particularly liked it when the Reverend Calvin Butts took off his watch, put it down, and said, 5 minutes. But those of you who know I'm a Baptist minister know what that means. I am not a Baptist minister, and I'm giving you fair warning right now because it's a subject, there are so many topics in it, we could each do a long panel on it. And what I thought I would do is try to take off from some of the things I heard this morning, and before anybody accuses me of it, to lower the level of the conversation. Because what I thought was that we use a lot of terms which we assume we all understand because they're all English regular words, but they convey quite different meanings to different people. So I will begin just by quoting Hillary Clinton a few weeks ago, who said that this government has turned Washington into an evidence-free zone. And although, as Peter pointed out to me, that's not quite accurate, it's what they've done with evidence which has changed the nature of the relationship between government and the findings of science in a way that's quite dangerous. And I think my colleagues here will talk about how do we get back on track. But the way I wanted to change things was to spell out some differences, then talk briefly about where were we. How do we get to where we are, and what can we do about what is a fairly difficult situation? For example, I hear science and technology talked about almost as one word, or research and development. Am I not?
Yeah, maybe we should move that up.
Oh, okay.
Let me help you, George.
Thank you. This is my Abbott and Costello act here. That science, sorry, when I was a student many, many years ago, science and technology had very distinct meanings. It was generally assumed that there was basic science, and then 25 years later, there would be a product so that you could make a very neat division between science and technology. And the technology usually related to engineers, and the science was basic science. Well, that has changed radically, as very often now, the idea is the product. If you look at what's going on in computer science, if you look at what's going on in so much of biotechnology, you don't need 25 years. The product is there as soon as the thoughts are finished. That changes the relationship of two very different aspects of science. The other is R&D. Again, if you look at the budgets, which can be quite reassuring, they stand for research and development. But if you begin to look at the figures more carefully, it's much less research and much more development. Then when you begin to look at the development, you say, aha, weapons, paying for this war, new weapons, more weapons, manned spaceships. And the research is getting smaller and smaller in terms of the very powerful basic research that has led to the revolution, which I believe will be in this next century of biology, and that funding on which we are going to be very dependent for intellectual breakthroughs is really getting squeezed. So don't be deceived by R&D figures until you go back and look at what is really for basic research, what is the National Institutes of Health for biomedical research, and what is making more and bigger weapons and paying for this war. So we've got that to think about on how things have been politicized. Let me just go back to where we came from within the last half century. You know, after World War II, Europe and Japan were devastated. We were not. We were not bombed. Our economy began to take off. We've already mentioned Harry Truman. And we also got these brilliant emigrants from Europe into our scientific establishment. Now, talking about emigrants, just in case there's anybody here who doesn't know, Walter Isaacson has written a perfectly brilliant book about Einstein. I'm saying this to make sure I get invited back again. Who will explain this period of history in the most readable way you can imagine? Let me put it in somewhat duller circumstances. We got a lot of first-rate scientists. Now, physics was already on its way to becoming a major science in this country, but with the influx of these people, we took off in a way that no other countries could. Germany, I believe, has never fully recovered from its loss of scientists and the structure of science, which has not kept pace with what some Frenchman said to me once, was the shoot from the hip approach of American scientists to basic science, which allowed overriding hierarchies. We came a great distance and became number one. Somehow or other, we've always believed that we would remain number one. Well, we're still pretty good in lots of areas. But not surprisingly, other countries, knowing just as well as we do the power of science and technology for fueling economies, keeping their populations healthy, of making new strides, are investing much more than we are in science. If you look at China, if you look at India, if you look now at some European countries, they are going to push much harder than we on seeing that science is really pushed ahead. We've got a lot of problems now with young people. And I spend a lot of time talking to young scientists, and the anxiety is enormous. The anxiety is about funding. Where do you go? I remember many years ago, on his 60th birthday, Jim Watson, who is now, he'll be 80 next year, so that's 20 years ago, gave a wonderful talk about how when he was a student, and a graduate student, if you were approved, if the proposal you put in for your research was approved, you were funded. All the alphas were funded, and a very high percentage of the beta pluses. He said that was beginning to change, I say it's 20 years ago. Now we're down to some horrible single digit, like 7% of all the alpha proposals are being funded, which means the majority of first-rate approved grants are not being funded. This has a ripple effect among young scientists who are our future. This is something we have to begin to think through about politicians looking at where the funding should go. A lot of young Americans have turned away from science. Fortunately, we're still strong enough that we're attracting the best of the Chinese and the best of the Indians and from all, many other countries, Taiwan, Canada. But this won't go on indefinitely. So again, we have to think of, and it is the federal government, we must remember, that funds science. Industry is a very small part of it. Big donors are a very small part of it. It is the federal government. Am I 5 minutes up yet?
Yeah.
Oh. Anyway, for those of us who lived through the golden age of science, it's a very difficult time now, which we really want to unpack in terms of the power of politics. And on this one point of where we've come from, this is off the wall, but I have to tell you, I have never heard Robert Krulwich in person before. And I've been so amused because every time I've heard him the past 2 days, he's introduced the bar mitzvah as metaphor. And I keep thinking, isn't that fascinating? Because I grew up in a very different era. I had an uncle who was an MD, PhD. He'd be 100 years old if he were alive today. That was very unusual then. And he had gone to Yale. He had all the right scholarships. And he was an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin in the biochemistry department. And he came back and he said to the head of the department, Professor Bradley, I've just been in Chicago. Now, this must have been late 30s, early 40s. And I have met the most brilliant German refugee scientist who is working just in the area we are, and he would love to come to Wisconsin. And we can get him for less than $3,000 a year. And Professor Bradley looked at my uncle and he said, you Jews are all alike. You get one of you and you want to build a synagogue. And they did not hire that man. Now, we hear about Einstein and the people who did so well, but I think in terms of seeing where we've come from, this same uncle was offered a job at the Mass General if he would change his name, which he refused to do, which is how he got to Wisconsin. Now the Mass General is headed by someone who is Jewish. So we've just seen the steady progression of a lot of stuff where talent, the meritocracy is really working. We've got labs at Harvard where only Chinese is spoken, only Japanese is spoken. And I think we're going in a good direction, but we have a responsibility now to keep our eyes on what our politicians are doing to keep us strong and to make up for some of the great weaknesses that are developing.
Thanks. That's something that has been of concern to me as well. We did a story in Time on the question of what has happened to the funding of basic science and the emphasis on basic science here in the U.S. and the dangers it poses to us economically as well as intellectually. Mm-hmm. And part of it has to do with the government not funding basic science nearly as much as it once did, and also private industry.
Right, way down.
Has stopped. You know, a company that is worried about what it's going to report to its shareholders in the next quarter is much less likely to invest a lot of money in basic research that may or may not pay off 20 or 30 years down the line. You talked about the difference between science and technology or research and development, and there's always the example that's always given is of Bell Labs, mm-hmm. owned by AT&T, that developed the transistor, which was basic research, and then was developed into pretty much every product, every electronic product that you see today. And there are many other examples. Peter, would you like to go next?
Sure. Thank you for coming out on a warm day. When it gets loud, at least maybe it means the wind is blowing. My background is in the sciences. I'm an environmental scientist by training, but an interdisciplinary one. I work on global water issues. I've done a lot of work on the issue of climate change and the impacts of climate change, on sustainability, how to think about sustainability. But I increasingly have been interested in the issue of the integrity of science, in part because I work at the intersection of science and policy. I do science for the purpose of influencing policy in the water area or in the environment area or the climate area. And also because a few years ago, I was threatened with a lawsuit. I was threatened with libel by one of the very few climate skeptics out there. You know, there are a lot of climate scientists, and there are a very small number of so-called skeptics who continue to this day to deny the reality of climate change. But I made a few comments about this individual to a reporter who published them in his newspaper, and I got a letter from a lawyer a couple of days later saying, withdraw these comments. I compared them to the Flat Earth Society, if you want to know. And so that piqued my interest. You know, what is the responsibility of a scientist to talk truth to the media and to the public? Eventually, to make that long story short, he went away when we wrote him a letter and reminded him about the First Amendment and that truth is a perfect defense against libel, and anyway, we didn't hear from him again. But partly because of that and partly because of the issues I work on, we started at the Pacific Institute a few years ago an integrity of science program to look at threats to the integrity of science. It's funded by a couple of foundations, by the Open Society Institute, by the Packard Foundation in California. And we look at misuse and abuse of science. And what I'd like to do with my little bit of time is talk a little bit about the broad concept and then talk a little bit about a framework for thinking about abuses of science. I have a section about solutions, which I'm not going to talk about right now, but which I'm hoping Michael will make sure the conversation comes back to. Let me start by saying that producing good policy without good science is really difficult. Producing good policy with bad science is a lot harder. And so that's a fundamental issue that I want you all to keep in mind. But let me also say at the beginning that I believe very strongly that science is only one piece of the puzzle in the policy arena. It is the responsibility, I believe, of policymakers to take good science, to review good science, to think about good science, and then it's perfectly within their rights to ignore it. There are other factors that policymakers have to consider. There's economics, there's equity, there's politics, there are all sorts of things. So I understand, and I don't want to leave you with a misimpression, that I think science has got to be considered and integrated into every decision. But I do believe at the same time that it is not within the right of a policymaker to misuse science or to seek out bad science to support a predetermined policy conclusion. And I think partly that's what we're worried about up here, and partly that's what I think we need to be worried about more broadly. I do believe that that problem, the seeking out of bad science or the misuse of good science, is becoming more pervasive than it's ever been. But I would also note that it's not unique to our era. And I would just point to Galileo, who was one of the best known victims of the conflict between science and ideology when he was committed to house arrest for the last 30 years of his life because the science that he produced didn't agree with the ideology, in this case religious ideology, of the time. So there is a long history of this. Okay, so let me describe two kinds of problems. The first are what I call logical fallacies. There's a whole set of logical fallacies that we need to worry about, and I'll describe them. And the second is a broader category of misuse and abuse of science. Now, By logical fallacies, this first category, what I mean is patterns of reasoning that are always or commonly wrong because of a flaw in the structure of the argument. And let me give you some examples. There's the argument from ignorance, an argument made just being ignorant of the facts. We see this a lot. There are arguments from error, another logical fallacy. That is an argument made based on something that turns out to be wrong. You make an argument, but the reason you made it turned out not just to be in error. There are arguments from misinterpretation. Okay, you think you know what's going on, but you're misinterpreting what the evidence tells us. There are arguments from ideology. This is a particularly common one. There are lots of categories, subcategories within this. There's arguments from personal belief. I believe something, and so this other thing just cannot be right. It's a logical fallacy, but often we see arguments from personal belief or arguments from incredulity. I just can't possibly believe that that's right, and so I believe this other thing. There are arguments from tradition or culture. My tradition tells me that this must be right, and so it doesn't really matter what the science or the evidence or the facts suggest that you're telling me. My tradition doesn't let me believe it. Those are all arguments from ideology. And sometimes they're religious and sometimes they're not, but they're pretty pervasive. And the Galileo example is an argument from ideology. The argument against Galileo was an argument from ideology. And I would argue we see a lot of that today in a lot of the things we see. We see it in arguments about sex education or evolution, which Lawrence, not me, thank goodness, will tackle. Lysenkoism in the Soviet Union in the 30s was a biological argument from ideology. And frankly, Lysenko was a Soviet biologist who couldn't wrap his mind around genetics. And it set back Soviet biology, frankly, to this day. And it was an ideological argument. A couple more, there are arguments from consensus. There's this incredibly large number of people who believe this thing, and so it must be right. Now, sometimes the consensus is right, but not because there's a consensus. If the consensus turns out to be right, it's because the science is right, not because a large number of people believe something. So arguments from consensus can sometimes be a logical fallacy. And there are others, but that's a broad category. The other one I want to talk about is a large set of misuses and abuse of science, and they include appeals to emotion, personal attacks or ad hominem attacks against individuals, mischaracterization of an argument, misuse of facts or selective use of facts. I'm going to come back and give a couple of examples just to pique your interest. Misuse of uncertainty, I'll come back to. Inappropriate generalizations, falsification, actual falsification of evidence, manipulation of funding, and Dorothy mentioned a little bit about funding, bullying of scientists. All of these things are abuses or misuse of science, and we see examples of them all the time. And I raise them as a framework so that maybe you in the audience can help identify misuses of science when you hear them. You say, oh yeah, that's a misuse of fact, or that's an ad hominem attack. That's not against the science or the evidence. That's against the individual. Just to go back to these logical fallacies. Well, no, I'll come to that one right now. Let me talk about ad hominem, because it's a very common one. And Lawrence, who has much more experience than I speaking on certain kinds of media, I think runs into the ad hominem attack relatively often. But a classic one is global warming is, quote, liberal claptrap. That's a quote from a congressman a few years ago. Well, I don't care what you think about the science. He's not arguing the science. He's branding it liberal. And for certain audiences, that's enough. That's all you need. It's ad hominem. It's the argument against the man, ad hominem, rather than an argument against the science. Here's another one. Al Gore can't be trusted on climate change. This is a quote. Al Gore can't be trusted on climate change because he lives an energy-intensive lifestyle. Okay, well, we all live energy-intensive lifestyles. Al Gore certainly may be more energy-intensive than many of us, although he talks about buying carbon offsets. But it's irrelevant to the argument about climate change. Whether or not he lives an energy-intensive lifestyle is irrelevant to the argument that Al Gore is making about the science. Okay, so keep your ear out for the ad hominem attack. You'll hear it if you think about it and you pay attention, you'll hear it all the time. Selective use of data. We see a lot of this. At the Pacific Institute, we run an Integrity of Science program. If you go to integrityofscience.org, we post a series of case studies on some of these. We posted one pretty recently on the selective use of data by the White House. On February 7th, Tony Snow, White House Press Secretary, said, "The United States is doing better than Europe on reducing greenhouse gases." Well, that raised a few eyebrows, and in fact, it led to, later that day, the White House posting a justification for that. And it turned out they were cherry-picking data. They picked a tiny little piece of data during which the U.S. did better than Europe and said, look, we're doing better than Europe. Well, in fact, we're not doing better than Europe. We're doing much worse than Europe. But they cherry-picked the data. Falsification, making it up. My favorite scientist, Ann Coulter, said on March 7th in a column she in March of this year in a column that she published, quote, "There are more reputable scientists defending astrology than defending global warming." There are more reputable scientists defending astrology than defending global warming. End of quote. Well, okay, she just made it up. She just made it up. It's false. She makes everything up. Well, I try not to read any of it, but the science, when she says something about science, I feel responsible for looking at it. Another quote from the same column, "Windmills can't even produce enough energy to manufacture a windmill." All right, well, that maybe is plausible. It turns out to be completely wrong. Windmills, over their lifetime, produce 20 to 80 times as much energy as the energy required to make a windmill. But she just made it up. So that's a problem. Certainty versus uncertainty. The tobacco industry certainly played the uncertainty card in science for decades. The global warming skeptics played the uncertainty card for a long time. They continue to, in part because science is a difficult thing. Science is not always certain. In fact, much of science is uncertain. And Michael, at the very beginning, talked about truth and fact in science. And I'm not sure what truth and fact in science is, because science is true only until it's something comes along that proves something else is true and that idea was wrong. And my favorite quote about this comes from Stephen Jay Gould, who said, quote, "In science, fact can only mean confirmed to such a degree that it would be perverse to withhold provisional assent. I suppose that apples might start to rise tomorrow, but the possibility does not merit equal time in the classroom." Well, I suspect he was talking about evolution. But there is this question about truth and fact that scientists love to talk about uncertainty because they need to. It's part of how we're trained, but it's often misused in the policy arena. There's another large category, packing advisory boards, which we've seen recently, imposing litmus tests on scientists, political litmus tests, before they will be permitted to serve on a political advisory board or a scientific review panel, altering and suppressing information, bullying scientists, selective funding and defunding. There are many examples, and the more we pay attention to what's going on, the more I think we'll be able to categorize some of the abuses and misuse of science and then hopefully move to solutions, which, again, hopefully we'll talk about later. Thank you.
Thank you. Just before we go on, I wanted to make sure you understand that we hope and look forward to questions from you. Yeah, no, we have plenty of time, but just be aware that we are eager to get questions at the end. Okay? Lawrence Krauss.
Okay, I'll try and be brief. It's hot. Michael asked me to speak after and just sort of fill in. And I've been on many panels with Dorothy, so I didn't prepare anything. So, anyway.
Ad hominem.
Yeah, that's right. No, Dorothy and I have tag teamed so many times, and I love being on a panel with her. Let me, I want to try and be more provocative to people other than Dorothy. Let me give you an example of how things have changed. I printed some stuff up. Things have changed regarding scientific integrity in politics and the interface, the politicization of science in many spheres. And I just want to give some examples and hopefully provoke questions because I really like to get to those personally. Here's a statement made to the National Academy of Sciences by the father of our current president when he was president. Science, like any field of endeavor, relies on freedom of inquiry, and one of the hallmarks of that freedom is objectivity. Now more than ever, on issues ranging from climate change to AIDS research to genetic engineering to food additives, government relies on the impartial perspective of science for guidance. That is a brilliant statement. That is a perfect statement about the interrelationship between science and government. Now let me read a statement from the current administration. This administration looks at the facts and reviews the best available science based on what's right for the American people. Do you get the subtle difference there? So you decide what's right for the American people, then you pick the science that works. Okay, that's a problem. And that's a severe problem. And I have to say that it's a problem that's caused a number of us to be very upset. But it's interesting to see the impact. So a few years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, 60 scientists, of which I was privileged to be a part, a very high-profile group that involved 20 Nobel laureates and 20 National Medal of Science winners, four advisors to presidents, including Republican and Democratic administrations. We wrote a letter to the president complaining about the abuse of the attack on scientific integrity in Washington in so many areas. Now, Peter's mentioned a few. They're just in almost every area you can think of, one has seen censorship, in particular censorship of government scientists on review panels, removing qualified people, putting people who are clearly unqualified, and distorting evidence, lots of it, global warming, where you could look at internal EPA documents which were edited at the White House, and the internal EPA review said this no longer reflects the current scientific consensus or scientific understanding. Peter mentioned condom research, where in fact, in terms of sex education, where studies have shown, and this is the lives of our children, studies have shown that abstinence-only programs don't work, that they have to be supplemented by other programs. And in fact, the studies in various Center for Disease Control that showed that were removed from the web. Were removed from the web because they said that, because it disagreed with the ideological view of the administration. Now, when we wrote the letter, we got a response from the White House, a response from the president's science advisor, who said, we don't do this, but we'll watch out and make sure we don't. And what we've seen is that, to a large extent, that hasn't changed. In fact, just this year, Jim Hansen at NASA, who's, as you probably know, been as responsible as anyone among scientists for promoting concerns about climate change, has said that never in 30 years has he been more muzzled than he was in the last year. When in fact, as you probably know, an administration official, a young junior person, not only refused to allow scientists to make statements without prior approval, but also said that such things as the Big Bang should not be talked about without the word theory and being used. So that hasn't changed, and that's of great concern. And that's one of the reasons why groups of scientists like the one I was at this last few days in Aspen have been meeting to try and think of how to raise the profile of science in politics, in the presidential campaign, because as has been said amply enough, we depend upon science for our future. Whenever, you know, the thing that amazes me is even those people who attack science, whenever it comes down to a problem, recognize that science is the way out. President Bush may have said that we should equally teach intelligent design and evolution in schools so our students know what the debate is all about. He said that. It's not an intrinsically stupid thing to say, by the way, surprisingly. Because, in fact, if there was a debate, it would be useful for our students to know about it. But, interestingly, when the avian flu epidemic, or potentially became an epidemic, when it first arose, President Bush and his advisors all said, we have to find how fast it's mutating from birds to humans. There's not one of them who said, you know, it's been designed to kill us. Let's just give up. Okay? Now, in terms of politics and science, there has been, of course, that has revolved a lot around religion lately. And, of course, I've been involved in it, so maybe I'm more sensitive than some. I first got involved in thinking about this, in fact, in 1996, when I wrote a piece for the New York Times, when Patrick Buchanan was running for president. You remember Pat Buchanan. And he said on ABC's This Week that he personally was not descended from monkeys, and if you had to actually think of anyone who was, I would think. Anyway, he didn't think that children should be taught that they are. And what amazed me is that no media person in the print media or on TV questioned that. They questioned everything else he said. They questioned his immigration policies, protectionism, everything. But no one questioned that statement, which is just sheer nonsense. Here's another statement. You know, I wrote another piece that got a lot of people upset in 2000. Well, actually, it was after 2001. But where I looked at what was happening in the Taliban back when they were allies in 2001, before September 11th, and then statements that were happening in the United States affecting science and politics. And you may remember House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, who, by the way, had a degree in biology, which is amazing to me. He introduced in the Congressional Record the following statement. The Columbine school shootings occurred in part, quote, because our school systems teach our children that they are nothing but glorified apes who have evolutionized out of some primordial mud. So evolution was responsible for the Columbine school shootings. It's in the Congressional Record. You can read it. These are problems, and these are things we have to face, and I just want to raise them to try and hopefully provoke some response. But finally, in response Dorothy. But when she talked about basic research, I want to point out that this is another aspect of science and politics. And too often when scientists speak, I usually don't like to talk about funding because the sense is that scientists are speaking out because we want more money. And we're being parochial. And I think when we often go to Washington to lobby for funds, that's what they think. But it is worth pointing out that there are severe concerns about the funding of basic research versus applied research. And we are seeing more and more that a lot of that used to be done in industrial labs like Bell Labs. But with the removal of that monopoly in particular, there's less free funding to support long-term basic research. And the examples of the problem, if at Bell Labs they had been assigned to do applied research and said, develop a better computer at the time, they would have developed computers with quicker cranks and wheels because those were the computers at the time. Instead, because they were free to do what they want, they invented the transistor, which has, of course, changed the world. Not because they were told to develop a transistor or not because they were told to develop better computers, but because they were free to do curiosity-driven research. And our standard of living now in this country relies on the curiosity-driven research of more than a generation ago. And I have severe concerns about how our standard of living in this country will be in 25 years if we don't support the kind of basic research we need to do, curiosity-driven research, because we don't know where it's going to lead. And I think I'll end with a quote from Robert Wilson. I don't think we used it this morning, but it's important. He was the first director of the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. And he was asked when that was being built at a congressional meeting, when he's testifying before Congress, they said, will this improve the defense of the nation? And he said, no. It will just help keep the nation worth defending. And I think we have to remember that science as a cultural activity is a vital part of what makes our civilization worth defending. Okay, that's it.
Great, thank you. Just a couple of quick comments, and then I'll have a couple of questions for the panel, and I hope you're burning to ask yours as well. One is that it is tempting to assume that one end of the political spectrum is worse than the other that happens to be one's own end at these things. And I feel that it is. But it is true that that people on both sides of some of these issues are capable of distorting science to make their own points. And I think about stem cell research, and that's one of these great examples that Peter was talking about, where there's what the science says certain things, but what we do about those things, the decisions we make are based on other factors, ethical and moral questions. So if we discover that embryonic stem cells can in fact be used to cure a lot of diseases, then the question is, okay, are we going to permit that to be done? And this will be very easy to misinterpret on my part, but there are some scientific discoveries that have been made in such unethical ways. And we talk about the experiments the Nazis did in the concentration camps. They actually learned useful things about human physiology by doing horrible things to people. And there's a general consensus among scientists that it is not appropriate to use this research because of the way it was obtained. Whether or not it could be valuable, it is just beyond the pale, and we will not use it. And some might argue that with embryonic stem cells, obviously not equivalent at all, but that while we might do great things with these stem cells, that as a nation we might decide we choose not to because we don't want to go there. But that's a political decision. It takes what we know from the science and then goes with it.
I have to jump in though for a second.
Okay.
No, I mean it's, you're absolutely right, but we have to still, before we can make that decision, we have to explain the difference between a blastocyst and an embryo.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, right. So I'm not saying we're at a point where we can make those decisions yet. And what troubles me is that there are people who would have you believe, and it is really true on both sides, that would have you believe that we know things that we don't yet know. And so you're all very familiar, I'm sure, with the arguments by political or religious conservatives that we shouldn't do stem cell research because anything you could do with embryonic stem cells, you could also do with adult stem cells. So we don't need to do this research. Well, that's just false. We don't know that. It may end up being true, but we don't know it, and we won't know it until we actually learn the scientific facts. Conversely, people who favor stem cell research sometimes will lead you to believe that we must do stem cell research because we know that this research will lead to cures for these diseases, or they'll strongly imply it. We don't know that either. It may be, for many reasons, that turns out not to be the case. So the point is that anyone can use this technique to distort science in furtherance of maybe a noble goal or maybe an ignoble goal, but it can be done on both sides. But it is absolutely true that taking what is known about science and distorting it or deliberately leaving some of it out, or Lawrence was talking about the controversy over evolution. I think it was you earlier who talked about the one reporter you saw who actually...
Yeah, the only reporter I know who actually said the truth, said what the science is, instead of qualifying it because they were afraid to...
Right, yeah. Right. And I will actually... In the total act of self-promotion, say that you missed the occasion where we said, we pointed out in Time that that people who are promoting intelligent design, and there's actually a very sophisticated, and I wanted to point this out too, the attempts to twist science in such a way that it produces the correct policy result. For a particular group, is becoming very sophisticated. There's something that calls itself a think tank in Seattle called the Discovery Institute, and they are actually very skilled at public relations and at coming up with the right phrasing to suggest things that aren't true, but that make people believe them. So when they talk about their thing, and you know this well, is that they put out these press releases and these statements saying, you know, we don't want, well, and you mentioned it, we don't want to ban the teaching of evolution. No, no, we're not like those people in the Scopes trial in the 1920s. All we ask is that, you know, science is about free and open inquiry. All we ask is that the schools teach the controversy about evolution. It's scientific truth. You know, this is what science is. We debate these issues, which implies that there is, in fact, a scientific debate, when, in fact, there isn't. There is no scientific debate about evolution versus intelligent design. There is a debate, but it's a political debate, and it's a debate about whether something that is not really science should be taught in science classes. So, yeah.
I mean, I just want to give the fact, people may not, you know, we're talking about these things, but I happened to be it was me debating the Discovery Institute when they first said that at an event in Ohio, let's teach the controversy. So just so you know the facts, so I went out and I looked, we looked at 10 million scientific articles and scientific citation index over 12 years, and looked at keywords for evolution, got about 150,000, but half of them were related to biological evolution at the very least. We didn't look for the keywords intelligent design in the scientific literature. Okay, came up with 88 articles. All but 11 of them were in engineering journals where you hope there's intelligent design. Of the remaining 11, 8 were critical of intelligent design. The remaining 3 weren't even in peer-reviewed literature. Then when I debated them with this, they said, well, we don't publish in the scientific literature because scientists are closed-minded. By the way, I've put out a challenge to them. I said, I want one of them to prove that they have been rejected more times than I have by scientific journals. Okay, no one's ever been able to show that from them yet. But they said, we publish books, like Darwin did. So I went to Amazon.com, okay, hit keyword evolution. I got 21,600 some odd hits. I looked, and most of them were biological evolution. Intelligent design, I got 600 hits. 300 were engineering. The remaining 300, 150 were critical of intelligent design, 150 books and articles on intelligent design in Amazon.com. Just for comparison, I hit the words alien abduction. I got 160. Okay, so if there's a controversy in schools that we should be teaching, it should be about alien abduction. Okay.
And this illustrates what Peter was talking about, the fallacy. The fallacy of consensus. But it doesn't really. It's sort of in the opposite way it does.
It does.
Okay.
First, I want to respond to something you said earlier, which is, I think, very important. There is a spectrum of science and policies. There's pure science that's of no political interest, and there's science that is of political and policy interest. And of course, the things that we're really talking about are those things, political or ideological interest. The things where we see the abuse of science or the misuse of science are where science comes up against somebody's belief or somebody's ideology or somebody's economic interest, in the case of tobacco, or perhaps climate change. And those are the interesting ones. Evolution, of course, is the religion. It is also a very important point that intelligent design is a very interesting concept, but it's not science. Mm-hmm. Maybe it ought to be taught in a religious class or a political debate class or something, but of course not science, because it's not a testable hypothesis. It cannot be proven false. It is by its nature not science. It is not science, capital N, capital S, not science. And that's an important distinction to make in some of these debates.
I would like to add just one thing here. We're really talking about the tip of the iceberg, but so much more is going on than these things, which are taken up by Time magazine and these kinds of discussions. And I said I was going to talk about where can we go from here. For people who are interested, the Union of Concerned Scientists is a group that was started in 1968-69 at MIT by people concerned about the future of nuclear proliferation. That has grown enormously. And if you look at their website, they have an alphabet of current scientific misuse and distortion of evidence. You will be sickened when you see what's happened to perfectly decent science that has now been manipulated politically. The organization is now enormous. It has all the Nobel Prize winners, et cetera, but it also has people like us. And I would push very much becoming part of their efforts, because it's a way to make the public debate much more visible, away from the things that are even as contentious that we're doing. There are ones that are much less contentious that are actually changing policy today.
And affecting health and welfare. Mm-hmm. Right. And we should say Union of Concerned Science is often said to be partisan in some sense. And that's why I brought up the letter. My politics are obvious, right? But there are people from a wide spectrum of political, and even in that letter we wrote to the White House, as I say, they were advisors to Republican presidents. And that's why I read the piece from George Bush, because it was a really good statement of science policy. This should not be, science is neither Republican nor Democrat, and we have to remember that.
Peter, quickly, can you talk to us about some of those solutions, and then we'll open up for some questions.
Sure. Obviously, there are many layers to this puzzle. Are there things we want the government to do, Congress to do, the executive branch to do, the scientists themselves to do, journalists, media? There was a little discussion about this at a very interesting session this morning on a similar theme about journalism. And so there really, there are lots of solutions. One at the federal level, or a series at the federal level, is, first of all, in 93, I think it was, after the Republican Revolution in Congress, the Office of Technology Assessment was abolished. OTA, for those of you who remember it, was an independent organization designed to provide scientific and technology advice to Congress. Congressmen and women would go to OTA and say, what is the story of, tell me what the status of the science is on nuclear waste disposal or on climate change. And they would write a report, OTA would write a report for Congress, and they would give them their advice on the best science. That's gone. There is no source for independent science advice directly to the Congress, other than things like the National Academy of Sciences, which is great, but which is not a federal organization. It's an independent organization, and they only do research when they're funded to do research.
And that was only $20 million a year and it's OTA.
It was a very small amount of money. Yeah. There are a whole series of independent advisory committees that used to advise Congress on science issues that have just been abolished. They ought to be reinstated. Congress, especially in proliferation, defense, a whole series of things, just abolished. There ought to be a requirement that there be no litmus tests for scientists, for advisory committee appointees to congressional advisory committees.
By the way, that there has been some progress there. After our letter, there was some legislation that was approved.
Well, yes, and after the elections in November, when this became a little more okay. We ought to guarantee open access to federal data. It's funded with your money, my money. federal data, federal studies, scientific findings. That ought to be just open access. But we're shutting down EPA libraries where the public can go and get access to data, access to reports, and so on. And none of that stuff's online, or very little of it's online. We ought to prohibit federal agencies and employees from modifying, censoring, or altering scientific findings that they didn't produce. And again, Lawrence gave some examples of that. There was some discussion about improving scientific literacy. We could have a whole session on that, science in the schools, and I would encourage that. Improving scientific communication. We have great scientific communicators up here from the media, but we need a lot more of them. And we're at a time when newspapers and TV to the extent that they've had science journalists, are cutting their science staffs. We should understand sources of funding and the way money is being used to fund science. There ought to be much more transparency of funding. I said at the beginning, our Integrity of Science program is funded by two foundations. You may believe the Institute has biases or those foundations have biases, but you at least know where our project money is coming from. And I think that ought to be a requirement for people working in this field. And I'm sure there are many more great ideas.
Well, the other solution, I think that people have to realize is that the people in the audience, the solution is you, right? We put up with a lot of nonsense. And first of all, in the voting booth, you can do it. But I think everyone here, and I, everywhere I go, I say, you have a wide group of people that you can influence in your churches, in schools, in the workplace. And I think we have a we need, and I don't want to sound like Al Gore here, but to raise the level of rationality and to not allow nonsense to go by with impunity. Anyway.
Okay, we're 10 minutes from the formal end of the session, so I'm going to. There's a lot more that people could say, but I'd love to hear some questions.
I just want to ask, have environmental scientists never been guilty of ad hominem attacks?
Because I cite the
example of Lomberg's book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, where he questioned global warming, and the answers to him were A, questioning his academic credentials, and B, saying that he was a traitor to the cause, neither of which really addressed the points that he raised in his book.
May I?
Please.
I'm going to respond in two ways to that. First of all, abuses of science are not Democratic or Republican. They're both. And it pains me when my environmental science colleagues do bad science, and they do, and I'm aware of it, and they ought to be called to the mat. Bjorn Lomborg, for those of you who don't know, wrote a book called The Skeptical Environmentalist a few years ago. He's a Danish statistician. At the risk of being a little ad hominem, the book is a piece of crap. But it's not a piece of crap because Bjorn Lomborg is a bad guy or because he's not a qualified scientist, but because his science is bad. Now, having said that, he makes some interesting points that are worth discussing. But a number of scientists wrote very detailed scientific critiques of that book. Very detailed scientific critiques, looking at his numbers, his assumptions, his analysis, and tore that book apart. There were other critiques that were ad hominem, and those deserved not to be weighed in the discussion of whether or not that book is worthwhile. Ad hominem attacks should be revealed for what they are. But having said that, that book was scientifically bad. And if you wish to look online at the critiques of it, I encourage you to do so.
On a similar note.
Stevie, could you identify?
Yes,
identify.
Oh, I'm sorry, right.
Steve Postrell. On a similar note, I was thinking about the issue. I did notice a kind of the heat shield to protect science is only on one side here, in the sense that I remember a man named Dr. Chris Knudsen, who back in the 70s did a study called the Market-Oriented Program Planning Study for the Carter Administration, who said, we're not going to run out of fossil fuels. That went against what the Carter Administration wanted to hear, and they fired him. There was a man named Ed Krug, who did the National Acid Precipitation Action Program Study under the, I think it was during the Reagan or early Bush years, I don't remember exactly, and he found that acid rain problem had been wildly exaggerated. Democrats in Congress got very upset with him. His career was destroyed. He was driven out of the field, and he couldn't do science anymore. This sort of thing goes on and on and on and on. So one of the things that bothers me here is I'm not really worried about James Hansen's ability to take care of himself. He's well-connected in the media. NCAR is running a political campaign practically out of a science office. I don't really think that's such a big problem.
Look, you're right in one sense. The job of politicians is to distort reality to some extent, right? But I mean, they try and promote what they're trying to do. So that has existed as long as politics existed. But you are, I think, being unfair. The key thing, and this is what the group of scientists looked at, it is qualitatively different at the present time in almost everywhere we could look, in almost every federal agency, to see scientists muzzled and advisory boards disbanded. And the real problem there is that there has been a mass exodus of scientists from the federal government service. And because of precisely that, and that does all of us damage, because we need the best possible scientists in this country working for the government.
Did we have them to begin with?
I would just add to this. Your point is exactly right. There are abuses of science throughout history, and the answer is to identify them and to put in place safeguards to prevent them and to correct them. And the examples you gave, I'm not familiar with, but I don't deny them.
You can look them up. Maybe I got some of them.
I'm pretty sure I got it right. I don't disagree. And I don't think anybody here is disagreeing with that.
Well, I'm sorry. I want to be a little stronger. I want to point this out.
Those are two. I have a long list.
I know they're a long list, but the point is that there are now actually about 25,000 scientists that have signed on because of a concern of what has been a recent growth in this very effort, qualitatively different than in the past. And I repeat, from all aspects of the political spectrum, and absolutely true, you can look at that. And the other thing you have to understand is that this group of 60 of us who signed this thing, I was shocked that there were that many who... Nobel laureates get asked to sign everything under the sun.
Sure.
And this represented a broader group of distinguished scientists than I've ever seen willing to speak up on what is obviously a political issue. So I think there are reasons to be concerned now. There are always reasons to be concerned, and we should all be that way. But I think there's unambiguous evidence that the situation is worse in the last decade.
It's an argument from consensus, right?
Okay. Well.
Thanks. My name's John Anda. You said that the solution lies with us, the public. So, and I wonder really, can the public ask a question of you as scientists? And that involves whether or not your interdisciplinary efforts are significant enough. And I'm not a scientist, but I'll take one example in something I'm familiar with, which is climate. If I made a statement like climate policy is a bet on climate sensitivity, which I believe it is, it would take many, many disciplines to answer that question adequately and to bring forth a nuance. Somehow, science got into and got the public debate into a very binary, is it or isn't it? And so, again, that's one example. But is there more that science can do to create incentives for the best people to be interdisciplinary rather than one discipline?
Well, first you should know that in federal funding right now, the emphasis is on interdisciplinary research. In fact, some of my colleagues are trying to point out that every now and then disciplinary research does something, because most of the big funding for centers around the country is precisely for interdisciplinary research, and it's important because the boundaries between disciplines are changing dramatically. The boundaries between physics and biology are disappearing in many ways, and we need to utilize the techniques of physics and biology. We need to utilize the techniques of physics and climatology, and so you're seeing a lot of that. At the same time, unfortunately, you're seeing that NASA is getting rid of funding for a huge program to look at planet Earth, just at a time when we need to do just that. So I'm not as concerned about that as you are. I'm quite concerned about the opposite, that in fact the funding for that we need to do just the kind of thing you're asking for in many ways is being removed because of, for other reasons.
I'd like to add something. That's a great question, because the climate debate was framed for a long time, I would argue, by the skeptics as a binary issue. If climate change is not a problem, climate change is a problem. Climate change isn't going to happen. Greenhouse gases aren't going to grow and warm up the atmosphere. Oh, yes, greenhouse gases are going to grow in the atmosphere, but they're not going to affect the climate. Oh, they are going to affect the climate, but just a little bit. Oh, they're going to affect the climate, but humans didn't have anything to do with it. It's been a series of yes-no debates, when, in fact, the real climate debate, I believe, is not a science debate. It's a policy debate. It's an interdisciplinary debate. It's what are the implications going to be for humanity? What are the impacts going to be? And what are we going to do about it? And that's an economic question. It's a political question. It's an equity question. And it's a science question. And science is going to feed that debate. But ultimately, it's going to be a policy. The policymakers are going to have to decide whether to do anything or not and what to do.
Look at the website of the Kennedy School of Government if you want to see the attempts that are being made to do just what you're talking about.
And there's also a large group at Princeton looking at this. That's one of the policy issues that I don't see enough talked about, and that science has provided a basis for, is the fact that if we act 10 years from now, it'll be qualitatively different than acting now. And that's why there's urgency. And the science supports that and talks about a wide variety of things that we can do, that it's also clear evidence that there's not one magic bullet. And so these are the things that really need to be brought out in the public so that rational policy can be made.
Thanks. We're pretty much out of time. Let's take one more question quickly, and then you can accost us after.
Sure. Greg Frost, real quick question, and from a very different way. How well of a job do you think we as scientists are doing at communicating to the general public the retractions?
The retract.
In other words, now there are certain things: intelligent design versus evolution. That one's pretty easy from my side when I look at it. But you take something like estrogens and medicine, others say, you know, we do things where we say things for many years, and then we turn around and say, you know what? We've done some more studies, and things aren't quite the way we thought.
You know, it's a really good point. Science, I mean, when I open a physics journal, I look at that and say, that's crap. And I don't have to worry about it because I know eventually what the way science actually works, the crap falls out. Right. And science actually demonstrates that. The Nobel Prize recently, as you know, was given for people who showed that what are those things called where you get...
Ulcers,
yeah, are not due to nerve are viral. So, and it, you know, it took a long time for those people to get in. Maybe Michael will respond to this. I've talked to journalists about this, and I have a big problem because a lot of science, unfortunately, is done by press release now, and journalists pick it up and they write it. But I almost never see the newspapers. When I read, I say that's nonsense. But when there's another paper showing that that's nonsense, that isn't news. Showing the old news is wrong is not news. And I think it's a problem, largely a journalistic problem, that retractions are not news, whereas wild and improbable claims are news.
Right.
And we
along those lines, I'm waiting in what I'm sure is vain for the Wall Street Journal's editorial page to apologize for its bad science on climate change.
Yeah.
And it's never going to happen, I don't think. But they've been wrong for so long, I think they owe it to their readers to say that we were wrong about the science of climate change. Let's have the real debate about what we ought to do, but the science of climate change is good.
Right.
So do you think as scientists communicated effectively?
Some do and some don't. Some do and some don't.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true that you don't see the paper. Something is on the front page. Example from Planetary Science. Evidence for life in a rock from Mars, evidence of fossilized life. And that was on the front page of every newspaper in the country. The papers that came out in a stream afterwards saying, no, probably not. Maybe. And in fact, the consensus now is that, no, it's not evidence. Most people still think there is evidence because that got much lower play. And it's partly the fault of journalists who think that, who do think that some major discovery is news, but the later discovery that it wasn't so after all is not so newsworthy. When it comes to things like health advice, the problem is, I think, shared in that institutions that do health research do put out press releases and flog the latest discovery in big headlines. And because people are interested, we pick it up. And it almost always represents the best that we know to date. But that doesn't mean it's the best we're going to know. And as we do more research, we find out that, no, in fact, margarine is not better for you than butter. It's worse. And people think, well, they can't make up their minds. But the truth is they keep gathering evidence. And what you'll see at the bottom of most stories that almost nobody ever reads and the bottom of the press release that almost nobody ever reads is more research is needed. Well, that's a very significant thing. And you'll also often see people shouldn't change their behavior based on this press release that we've trumpeted in huge, more research is needed, and that's because more research is needed.
But to come back, the scientists are partly at fault. We obviously have to do a better job communicating. It's one of the reasons I spend a lot of time trying to do it. We haven't communicated well enough the nature of uncertainty, risk, key things that the public needs to understand, and so we have to do a better job as well.
Okay, we have to stop, but you're free to talk to us afterward. Thank you.